Well, where to begin? The Black Lives Matter movement that erupted last year after a white police officer brutally murdered George Floyd by pressing his knee on Floyd's neck. We now know it was 9 minutes and 29 seconds. And this was a murder that was so public and unfortunately criminally common that it sparked the biggest protest movement in history for racial justice. And in the pictures, I mean, you can just see the size of it, I think.
Okay, now, just to interrupt you for 1 second, you're sharing the wrong screen, so we don't have the pictures that you're referencing. So if you could take a moment to, sorry to interrupt.
There we go. Is that better?
No, I'm sorry. Yes, that's okay. Better. Got it.
Cool. Well, yeah, there you can see the Minneapolis police station being burnt, which was definitely one of my favorite stories of Black Lives Matter. So I think importantly, Black Lives Matter launched, I think, the issues of systemic racism into the fore and made people question why racism exists, where it comes from, who benefits from it, and importantly, how we can get rid of it for good. And today there are many different explanations for racism. So today liberal ideas dominate, which when it comes to racism, generally means that people believe racism is a long established feature of human societies. Another common belief is that racism stems from fear, in particular the fear of differences and otherness. There are also liberal common sense ideas that believe that racism is just a flaw that can be solved at both an individual societal wide level through, you know, education and things like that in order to promote tolerance. In addition to these general liberal views on racism, there are also more theoretical approaches like identity politics and privilege theory. And these also rely on liberal assumptions, I would argue. They see racism as something that is autonomous from class society, and they accept racial categories as essentially natural. So instead of examining the origins of these categories and who interests they serve, they essentially just accept them. These ideas offer different strategies of how to end racism at best, and at worst offer no way to overcome racism at all. So Marxists disagree with all of these ways of understanding racism and why racism exists. And I want to argue today that Marxism is a tool that can actually allow us to understand why this social phenomena came into existence. And importantly, I think Marxism offers a way out of it. So Marxists argue capitalism, a system that relies on the exploitation of the majority for the benefit of the few at the top, brought racism into the world, and that it is now this system that relies on racism to maintain its order. Racism is rooted in the political structures of the state, the education system, the media, and other capitalist institutions. So by locating the origins of racism in capitalism, we seek to determine the cause of it in order to overthrow the system that creates and perpetuates this oppression. All right, so why is racism useful to capitalism? So capitalism is fundamentally divided by class, in which production is determined by profit accumulation. Production is controlled by a minority of people, the ruling class, which I'm sure you now know if you've been through other sessions, who privately own and control the means of reproducing society. So that is the factories, offices, call centers, warehouses, and you can see that in the picture as well. And then there is the majority of us, the working class, those who do not control production and are given a wage in exchange for doing all of the work that makes society run and, importantly, that generates profits. This exploitative relationship between the ruling class and the working class you can actually find in every single workplace in the world, which means that capitalism is fundamentally unequal. And importantly as well, this inequality that I just talked about, exploitation, is also then expressed in all of the institutions of capitalism. Racism is one of the key oppressions used by the ruling class. to facilitate its ability to exploit workers. And it has three key functions that are deeply intertwined. So the first is to divide workers against each other. And by presenting workers of different races as fundamentally different or a threat to each other, it obscures these common class interests. So as a result of portraying society as divided by race, it encourages workers of each race to falsely identify with the ruling class of their own race, despite their counterposed class interests. And I think a common example of this is nationalism. So, of course, especially at the moment, we hear, you know, governments argue for stronger and more militarized borders. And they always say that, you know, this is in the national interests of Australians or whatever. You know, but also they're, you know, obviously use excuses like keeping refugees locked up in detention centers for almost a decade as a justification, you know, for this national security projects. And they, you know, I guess kind of like use these excuses by also using racist logic and saying that, you know, refugees are the threat to national security and they might, you know, steal your jobs, but also simultaneously be on welfare, because I guess they're just that talented and, you know, multitask just very well. And of course, like the ruling class can't come out and just simply say that the reason they do need stronger borders is to protect their imperial interests in the region, because capitalism, of course, is organized by nation states competing against each other for bigger and bigger shares of overseas markets. They need to justify it in a palatable way and win working class people to their political project. Another example of that is Islamophobia. So, and this has been a topic, I think, throughout the conference a lot. But yeah, it's been 20 years since the US war in Afghanistan, a war that created the category of the Muslim terrorist, a war that created Islamophobia, a war that was not, in fact, about saving women and children from the supposed Muslim threats, but a war that was about securing the economic expansion of American imperialism. And the racist ideas used to justify this war gave us, of course, the infamous Cronulla riots in 2005 here in Australia, where, you know, we saw white men draped in Australian flags who then went on a racist rampage for 6 hours, beating up anyone who looked Middle Eastern. And at the time, most politicians raised fears about the failure of Muslims to integrate and speak English. John Howard, who was the prime minister at the time of this event, described the burqa as confronting and accused Muslims of holding jihadist views and extreme opinions about women. I think as well, Islamophobia is now integral to the growth of the far right and is the preferred excuse, really, that is used by many governments to pillage the Middle East and, of course, you know, secure endless funding for the military. Another example, I think, with this kind of like category around nationalism, I think is kind of like, and racism, is the Northern Territory intervention, which was, of course, used, well, justified by, in a very racist way, by portraying Aboriginal people as drunks and child abusers, where, of course, the real intention for the intervention was land theft. All right. Secondly, racism is used to undermine the conditions of workers and help intensify exploitation by having groups of workers work for less in degrading conditions. And again, because workers have, you know, a common material interest in things like, you know, increased wages, stronger unions, more legal protections, and of course, as well, ultimately the overthrow of capitalism, obscuring this common interest is of great importance for the ruling class, and it is essential for them maintaining their order. So think of like migrant workers on 457 visas who fear joining their union or standing up for themselves when they're being underpaid, because their ability to stay in the country is attached to their employer. We also see large sections of migrant workers on meager wages, and there was like a huge, expose of that this year. To look at another industry in hospitality, the fact that migrant workers can be paid as little as $8 an hour means that the entire wages and conditions of that industry can be kept at such a low rate. So racist ideas rest on the economic competition stoked between workers, where they are forced to compete against each other for jobs and other necessities. So bosses can exploit these racial national differences and pit workers against each other to downplay their common class oppression. And racism doesn't just exist on an interpersonal level, between like individuals or things like that. It is in fact a structural form of oppression that is rooted in capitalist exploitation in the workplace. And it's also expressed through inequalities in treatment by bosses, state institutions, and the media and so on. And thirdly, racism is a tool that is used to sow divisions more broadly. So in order to maintain their rule, the capitalist class relies on their domination over what ideas are around at any given time. So to quote the very famous quote from Marx and Engels in the German ideology, they said this, the ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas, i.e. the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. So what this means is that the ruling class has a monopoly, a domination over what ideas gain purchase in society, and as well kind of like what ideas are actually absorbed by ordinary people. So an example of this, of course, is the infamous Apex Gang, which was absolutely, fabricated by the Herald Sun at a time where there was a fight between the Liberal and Labour governments in Victoria to see who was going to win the next state election. And they were trying to wedge each other over questions of violence. At least the Liberals were trying to do that. And instead of the Labour government saying, of course, there is no, Apex Gang, there is no, there are no gangs, they went harder and said that they were going to be tougher on crime. And those are just some of the, extremely racist, media news articles at the time. Okay, well, to turn, to the origins of racism, I think this is, of great importance for Marxists because we argue that racism is a historical invention and not a biological fact. And it has not actually always existed throughout all of human history. In fact, the origins of what we understand racism to be are relatively recent and are found in the rise of the African slave trade and the system of plantation slavery that was developed in the New World more than 400 years ago. So the New World is basically the Americas, which is very handy to have that map there so you can know what the New World is. 12 million African people were made slaves between the 1500 and 1870. Over 1.5 million slaves died during the Middle Passages between Africa and the New World. And once in the New World, between a tenth and a fifth of the slaves died within a year. Slavery was the engine that made the construction of the New World possible and is the basis for primitive accumulation, which allowed the establishment of capitalism in America. So slave-grown tobacco, sugar, and cotton fueled the economic expansion of the colonies. New World slavery was predicated upon absolute exploitation. And what I mean by absolute exploitation is that the slaves met their own needs in 1 or 2 days' work a week, and then they would work the remainder of the time for their owners, which was a rate of exploitation and surplus extraction with a few parallels even amongst other slave systems at the time. All right, well, I I want to compare what is called the ancient world versus the new economic model of slavery that was beginning to form in the new world, because slavery was not always racialized. And there is a tendency in liberal academia and anthropology to argue, I guess, that racism has always existed and that pre-capitalist societies and empires used racism in the same basic way that it is used today. And I would argue that this is, in fact, not racialized in the same ways. And of course, this doesn't mean that these, so some of these examples. So Greek slave tutors, they also had Egyptian slave administrators, English slave servants, German slave laborers, and many, many more. So of course, these were still brutal societies, but not driven to racially codify labor the way the New World was beginning to do so. Slavery existed in Africa as well, prior to the transatlantic slave trade. And in Africa, slaves were often soldiers or recognized concubines. The social meaning was different to the emerging slave trade in America. And some of the key differences were that the new slave and other forms of slavery was that now a slave could be sold, shipped out, surveilled very closely, his entire kinship wiped out, and he was placed into a system of social identification. So I guess to put it in other words or more simply, Roman slaves were sold because they had been captured, while many African slaves entering this transatlantic trade had been captured in order to be sold. And I think that that is like an incredibly important fact. And also racial ideology, I guess, emerges at a particular time in a particular place. And I think for reasons that are incredibly understandable and comprehensible and that have absolutely nothing to do with human nature. And to quote the Trinidadian historian of slavery and racism under capitalism, Eric Williams, he very famously put it, and he said, "Slavery was not born out of racism, rather racism was the consequence of slavery. Its purpose was to ideologically justify and maintain an extremely profitable system of unfree labor." And as well, in Wage, Labor and Capital, Karl Marx argued the following. So he said, "What is a Negro slave? A man of the black race. The one explanation is worthy of the other. A Negro is a Negro. Only under certain conditions does he become a slave. A cotton spinning machine is a machine for spinning cotton. Only under certain conditions does it become capital. Torn away from these conditions, it is as little capital as gold is itself money, or sugar is the price of sugar." So even in 1847, Karl Marx was arguing that there is nothing inherent to Black people that makes them free labor, that racism was a tool to force a group of people into barbaric conditions in order to accumulate profits. The ruling class in this period as well was experimenting with different forms of labor and labor control. So alongside slaves, they also had both indentured servants and wage workers. And simultaneously as well, they were also trying to deal with, of course, indigenous populations that often accepted neither of those roles and would rebel all of the time. The capitalist class believed that stratifying the oppressed populations into different forms of labor would naturally divide them. And of course, none of that is true. And luckily, history also speaks for itself. And there are many, many, many slave rebellions that begin to emerge. And those are some images from the Haitian slave uprising. Irish servants, especially those who had to endure long periods of servitude, were known to conspire with Black people, as they did in Bermuda in 1661. Irish servants in Barbados in 1686 were accused of being concerned of privy to the late intended rising of the slaves to destroy all masters and mistresses. In the 1960s, again, Irish servants and freemen in Barbados were imprisoned on charges of aiding the French and of being prepared to support slaves, rebellious slaves. The Catholic Irish were often excluded from the militias, while some Blacks were armed. Another amazing example is Beacon's Rebellion, which was a multiracial uprising where over 500 Blacks slaves and indentured servants, both Black and white, marched into Jamestown, Virginia. They deposed the governor, burned the plantations, and held off planters' militias for several months. So, yeah, I guess the basis of unity, of course, between European and African laborers was a shared experience of class oppression. And this created the need for racist ideology to emerge. And this is important because, of course, they had to offset somehow the tendencies towards solidarity. And they needed a key tool, I guess, to ideas around bourgeois revolutions, so like liberty, equality, fraternity. And these ideas are completely incompatible with slavery. And biological racism gave them a way out to continue to have both the growing economic rights of the ruling class and slavery. So while it is true that, I guess, forms of oppression can reinforce and perpetuate and play off from one another, Marxists want to argue that these forms of oppression indeed stem out of material relations that shaped capitalism at the time, and that at the core of them, they held the economic exploitation of ordinary people at the core. So it is the material and economic structures of society that give rise to the range of ideas and various ideologies that serve to justify, explain, and perpetuate the status quo. All right. Well, you cannot have racism, I guess, without the construction of race and vice versa. So the social nature of race is displayed in the shifting categories we see across different places and periods in history. Race changes based on the material needs of capitalism. So if race was, you know, of course, actually based on permanent innate divisions of human beings, we wouldn't see all of these shifts. And the American government is a key perpetrator when it comes to shifting race all of the time. So people of Mexican birth and ancestry were white up until the 1930s census. And this has continued to flip-flop depending on the current thinking about their role on labor or immigration. Similarly, courts went back and forth in the earlier 20th century about whether people from Japan, for example, were white, and finally deciding in 1933 that they weren't based on the common understanding of what the white man was at the time. And as well, I think that the definition of white people has always been just as a political and arbitrary, I guess, category as other explanation and shifts on other races. And I have this quote of what I guess the US describes a white person to be. So bear with me. It's quite a mouthful. So it says, "A white person has been held to include an Armenian born in Asiatic Turkey, a person of but 1/16th Indian blood, and a Syrian, but not to include Afghan Americans, Indians, Chinese, Filipinos, Hawaiians, Hindus, Japanese, Koreans, Negroes, nor does white person include a person having 1/4 of African blood, a person in whom Malay blood predominates, a person whose father was a German and whose mother was a Japanese, a person whose father was a white Canadian and whose mother was an Indian woman, or a person whose mother was a Chinese and whose father was the son of a Portuguese father and a Chinese mother," which is, I mean, I think it's quite hilarious. And it's, just completely shows how arbitrary and constructed it is. Race is not a natural, unchanging phenomena. It's not an unmoving category. It is, in fact, a political category disguised as a natural one. And I think that the above example shows you the political differences and relationships that different races have in society that I think are fundamentally created by oppression and shift and change, I guess, based on the necessities of capitalism. I think as well, though, an estimated gap of approximately 10 years between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. And according to a 2018 report by the Australian Medical Association, Indigenous people experience a burden of disease that is 2.3 times higher than those of non-Indigenous Australians. And an important underlying cause of this is the continuing social and economic exclusion faced by Indigenous people. And it is a direct result of the history of Australian, capitalism and exploitation that has been enacted by federal, state and territory governments. As well, according to the Bureau of Statistics, as of September 2019, Indigenous people represent 28% of the total adult prison population in Australia, despite being less than 3% of the overall population. So now to turn to America, Edward Lee's article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science found that 1 in 1,000 Black men and boys can be expected to be killed by police at some point in their lifetime. The Black males are 2.5 times more likely to be killed by police than white males, and that dying at the hands of a law enforcement is a leading cause of death amongst young Black men. So in all of these instances, I guess, the social relations of production lead to these sorts of inequalities. And what I mean by that is basically capitalism. All right, well, there are many ideas, I guess, about how we can get rid of racism and who benefits from oppression. And as Marxists, we reject ideas like white privilege or ideas that argue that anyone who doesn't suffer a particular form of oppression are at best benefiting materially from other groups being oppressed and at worst, the oppressor themselves. These are theories, I guess, that argue that oppression starts in the interpersonal sphere and that it is individuals with bad ideas who then are part of these institutions who operate in oppressive ways. So changing some of these individuals in these institutions with people of particular oppressed groups could fix that. So of course, here we have AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, participating in the Met Gala, which is, a place where the 1% gets to meet and donate more money to essentially themselves. And she is meant to represent, of course, Latinas, Black people, as part of the Democratic Party. And then we have a Black protester literally outside of where she's wearing that fancy dress, getting arrested and protesting for Black Lives Matter. So the idea that someone like AOC can represent this working class person is, I think, pretty ridiculous. And I think these sorts of ideas completely dismiss the real purpose of racism, which is to exploit and divide ordinary people. Because these theories are wrong about where racism comes from, i.e. individuals, and who causes it, they are unable to get rid of racism and oppression. These politics point the finger at ordinary people and give cover to the class, which actually oppresses working class people, which is the ruling class. And of course, ordinary people have backwards ideas. That is undeniable. They absorb them from all of the institutions that the ruling class controls. I think importantly, however, though, these ideas can shift through struggle. So privilege theory and identity politics don't help you understand why, for example, Kamala Harris isn't actually helping, lift millions of Black people, Latinos out of poverty by raising the minimum wage in America right now, or why people like Barack Obama deported more migrants than any other president at the time, why he bailed out the banks during the global financial crisis of 2008, instead of helping, the millions of ordinary people, and who needed to recover their homes, and why Black Lives Matter erupted under his presidency in 2014. These individuals are part of the ruling class whose interests they will pursue above all else. Similarly, here in Australia, we have people like Noel Pearson and Marcia Langton who argued for the Northern Territory intervention and who were Indigenous themselves So there is no correlation with your identity, with one, being inherently progressive, and two, having the interests of ordinary people at heart. What defines this is your position in society as being part of the working class. So structural oppression in the first place comes out of the fact that capitalism is a class society where the majority are oppressed and exploited, and a minority benefit from that. And oppression is a structural phenomena. It is the political, social, and economic exclusion from society. So Marxists argue that the working class, and they are a collective bunch, a group that includes people of all genders, sexualities, religions, and races. So you might think that the working class looks like that, which is a white guy wearing fluoro with a hard hat, when the working class, in fact, looks a lot more like this. So this is, when we say the working class, this is what we mean, not the white guy in fluoro, although he's also part of the working class, just not the majority. But yeah, so because capitalism, so workers have the power to strike, to stop work and bring production to a halt. This is something that gives them incredible economic power, as they can shut down and, you know, shut down the flow of profits, which is a key thing that bosses want. And workers have given us so many different examples. Ultimately, race and racism have their roots in capitalism. And so long as capitalism exists, the ruling class will continue to rely upon and stoke racism to maintain its rule. And I think the task of everyone here today is to overthrow this system. And I think we need to argue for politics that can unite us in struggle, politics that identify where we have power, and importantly points the finger at those who benefit from racism, which is the ruling class. And ultimately, I think if you want to get rid of racism for good, you need to become a revolutionary socialist today. But yeah, I'll just leave it there.